fallout from the far-right race riots in early August in England and the north of Ireland continues. Recently, the CEO of Telegram has been arrested in France. However, what was missed in this context was an actual deep dive into the situation in the north of Ireland and the implications in the island of Ireland more broadly and how this ties to England. So, as part of a series on the permanent state, Samantha Asumadu interviews Jerry Carroll, MLA for the People Before Profit Party, about the history of the far right in the north of Ireland, how this intersects with housing issues, and the ties to all of this across the rest of the United Kingdom.
Thank you very much for taking the time. I just want to go through really, perhaps first, if you could introduce yourself and tell me a bit about your party and People Before Profit.
No problem. Thanks. So People Before Profit are an All-Ireland socialist party. So we have elected reps north and south in the councils in the north and the south of Ireland, in the legislatures in Belfast and Dublin. And we're a James Connolly socialist party. So we really believe that the main divide in society, contrary to what the right and far right are focusing on, is not race, ethnicity or religious belief, if any, but it's between the rich and the rest of us, the rest of the working class, the rest of society. But obviously, like the tradition of James Connolly and others on this island, I think when it comes to tackling racism, we need to understand that not only is it poisonous and dehumanizing towards refugees, asylum seekers, people of color and many others, but it's fundamentally a divisive strategy to split and divide the working class movement across this island. And obviously, there's a legacy and a modern day problem of sectarianism, and quite often whilst they're different, they go hand in hand in terms of the same people who tend to be violently sectarian or are usually quite racist and so on and so forth. So basically, what distinguishes us from other parties in Ireland is that we believe that the real change comes from the mass of people organising from below. And we use our platforms in Stormont, in the Dáil, in the councils to try and articulate people's grievances against the system. They're rightful grievances. They're right to be angry, as we always say, but they should be angry and need to be angry at the political and economic system. And I think other parties kind of just say, vote for us and we'll change things on your behalf. We obviously do stand in elections and have elected reps, like I said. But for us, it's the self-activity of ordinary people that really changes things. And I think you've seen a big pushback, rather, in England in the last few weeks and in the north against sort of far-right agitation. And that's really came about not by wonderful speeches, and some people have given wonderful speeches on the demonstrations, but by large numbers of people coming out. So, yeah, we're active in many campaigns, anti-racism, worker struggles, okay, environment. So that's maybe a quick summation.
Yeah, I think we'll dig into that a little bit, actually. But first, I just wanted to get some details. So where does your party operate? Where, which parts of Ireland, like Galway and Cork and so on, or do you target specific places where you think that there is more sort of anti-immigrant, anti-asylum seeker behaviour, and how many sort of represent, are you trying to get more council members or MPs? I'm not sure if you actually call them MPs there. Maybe it's something different. That was a lot of questions, but hopefully you
no problem. So listen, we have branches all across the country. I don't think with every county in Ireland, but most counties, we've got branches. Like I said, in Belfast, we've got councillors, a councillor, and an MLA, what's so called the local people elected to Stormont. And Derry, we have a councillor as well. And we've got branches in between of varying sizes in the north. In the south, we've got a high concentration of, we've five elected TDs, what's known as MPs, in the Dáil, in the Southern Parliament. And we have many branches, I don't know how many that has counted, a lot of branches in Dublin, branches in Cork, Kerry, Galway, Carlow, and lots of other places. So we have our branches, obviously, in those places, and in some cases we have elected reps in some of those areas, and obviously in most, if not all, those areas, we've been involved in some form of anti-racist protest. And not always, but usually us instigating alongside others in terms of taking a stand to welcome migrants and to push back against racism.
Okay, so I will ask you, you mentioned Cork. So I went to university in South Wales. I went to, it's now called South Wales University. It was called University of Glamorgan. And so I knew a lot of people who came from Cork to my mm-hmm. uni. And I kept over, I kept in touch with some for a while, and since some have died and so on. But early in the week, I spoke to someone else who told me, so obviously Cork is by the coast. So that is where, if there is asylum seekers or migrants coming, that's likely where they're going to sort of first port of call. And beyond that, Dublin. However, you have somewhere like Galway, which isn't a port. It's further away, etc. But I am told that there's more anti-migrant and anti-asylum seeker activity there than there is in Cork. I find that quite odd. Do you think you could comment on that?
Not aware of the detail, obviously, based in Belfast. But I mean, in some cases where there's, low levels of migration or asylum seekers, there sometimes can be that a high level of anti-racist activity because things are not diverse, but I'm not sure of the kind of scale and sort of numbers in terms of the demonstrations in Galway or Cork. But Dublin tends to be is where most of the agitation is concentrated, and that's obviously groups like Coolock Says No and other community groups Say No, which basically they emerged out of initially protesting against, government policy on water charges and different things.
Water charges? When did they come in?
They haven't been brought in yet, but there was a big protest movement in 2015, I think, 2014.
Right, 2015. It goes back further, because I was going to ask you then about COVID. Is that when all these sort of community groups Say No started? But it's actually before that.
So, some of them before, yeah, but then obviously in terms of making a shift, in terms of focusing on far-right stuff exclusively and, conspiracy theories and obviously migration, COVID really was the game changer, Samantha, in terms of bringing a lot of people out specifically on those issues. And and there wasn't a lot of sort of left-wing or anti-government from the left sort of demonstrations because of COVID in the south. There was a bit more of those that we were involved in terms of Black Lives Matter protests in Belfast, but by and large it was kind of the COVID period that put a lot of people down a rabbit hole, and kind of people's worldview were turned upside down, and some people kind of obviously drew the wrong conclusions thanks to algorithms and thanks mm-hmm. to kind of foreign agitators.
So what does drawing the wrong conclusions look like? Can you give me examples of what these people would sort of, because of algorithms and so on, what sort of theories were they coming up with?
Well, that's different stuff, when you see different people sharing things, but this idea that, sort of great replacement theory in different guises, maybe not always called that, but the idea that, Irish people are going to be, recolonized by migrants or asylum seekers. So that stuff is not mainstream, I don't think, but certainly on the kind of far right social media stuff, they kind of share this kind of nonsense, and some people obviously buy into it, unfortunately, which is kind of like obviously completely wrong and offensive and all of those obvious points, but it negates the fact to say that, Ireland is actually underpopulated. There's been obviously forms of sort of great replacement theories and stuff spread by the far right, but, I was making the point to think about Ireland actually being underpopulated, and they should be able to take in, more immigrants and asylum seekers and so on and so forth.
Remind me why it's underpopulated.
Sorry, yeah. So since... the 1840s, obviously there was a famine, and a million people died and a million people left Ireland. And obviously those people didn't come back. They went to America, Australia, England, and other places. So actually Ireland in theory could take in a lot more asylum seekers and migrants, but the far right are kind of focusing in on relatively small numbers of them, don't have percentages at hand here, but they're obviously trying to, what they're feeding off is a real housing crisis. There's a severe housing crisis in the south of Ireland. There's one in the north, but the price of housing in the south really is completely out of control. Private rented accommodation is unaffordable for many. Government aren't really building homes in a way that they should be. So in that context, you know, the far right are kind of saying, look at these asylum seekers. They always focus on the fact that some of them are male. Look at these males coming into our country. These people are being housed and our quote-unquote local people aren't. And that's really what they're trying to build. And unfortunately, with varying degrees, they've had some successes in the south in the last few years, I suppose.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about housing, both the south and the north. See, I know that I had a look at your website and saw that there is an issue, and you've specifically identified that it's an issue for young people. Could you extrapolate on that a bit, please?
Yeah. Well, housing really, it's unaffordable for most people in the south. You know, before the Celtic Tiger and the economic boom, and you know, everybody was told to, you know, buy a house, get a mortgage, and or rent if you wanted to. And for many, many people in their 30s, even in their 40s, that's simply not an option. You know, the prices are completely out of control, particularly in Dublin, but, you know, elsewhere in the south, and, you know, more so in the north. Whereas the north, I think, in Belfast, the highest increase across the UK in rent in the last 2 years has been Belfast percentage-wise. So we're now talking £1,000 a month in Belfast, which, you know, people in London may think that sounds cheap, but obviously wages are lower. Wages are lower in the north. So really, there's a real problem. You know, governments aren't really building homes at any real level. And people are obviously getting angry, and they should be angry. They should be agitated. But the question is, who are they blaming? You know, you know, there's a rising number of people blaming, letting the government off the hook, letting the landlord class off the hook for charging ridiculous rents, and obviously blaming sort of, you know, migrant asylum and people of colour.
So in the article that I read on your website, you specifically sort of identified speculators as being one of the people that are, you know, basically oppressing the 99%, let's say, who aren't rich. And you said that there was an effort to do a tax on profits of these speculators. And then, unfortunately, they made, what was it, 644 appeals, which unfortunately did sway, is it Jack Chamberlain, to fold on that. Is that right?
Yeah. I think so. I think it was in the Doyle, I think. So obviously it's not aware of the full detail, but I mean, there's a huge body of landlords. I think it's 1 in 6 in Stormont who are registered landlords, and 1 in 5, I think, in the Doyle are registered landlords. So the politicians, north and south, a lot of them are registered landlords. Some may be unregistered and may have sort of investments in other avenues in property, but they themselves, a large portion of them, are landlords. And then the portion who aren't, kind of getting to your point, Samantha, always tend to operate in the interests of the landlord class. So we talk about rent controls, which we attempted to introduce in Belfast. Rent reduction and rent freezes we attempted to introduce in Stormont 2 years ago. We had MLAs losing their minds and saying this is out of control, you can't do this, and a bit of a shambles in Stormont. But the reason for that, in our assessment, it's because these people either are directly landlords or they operate by and large in the interest of the landlord class, which means basically these people, landlords, can't be touched. There can't be any regulation of any meaningful measure on them. And the result is a housing crisis and people obviously trying to stir up racism in that context.
So who introduced this bill into your parliament to tax the profits initially?
You're talking about the one in the Dáil, I think?
Yeah, I mean the one that had 644 appeals against it. I'm not sure what it was called.
I'm not sure. I think it might have been Richard Boy Bard or Paul Murphy in our party, because we've introduced a few housing bills in the Dáil. Okay. But I'm sitting in storm with, obviously, so I think it was Paul or Richard maybe.
Okay, I'll check up on that. But just so to follow on from that then, in that case, who are these speculators tied to? Because to do appeals, for one, you probably need a lawyer, or if not, some sort of specialist. So they've got money. Obviously, we know they have money. But they also probably need some advice within Parliament to tell them the best way to do the appeals or something. So I'd just like to dig in and see who's advising them.
Well, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the government parties, you know, are connected to the speculators and vulture funds and landlords. So it's definitely them.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Well, then, I mean, you guys seem, you know, you're pretty proactive. So what I can see is that you think that there should be some sort of state construction. What does that look like?
Absolutely. We've called in the south for a state construction company to build public homes, social homes. And in the north, it's slightly different. We have a housing executive where the basically was set up on the back of the civil rights movement, where we had the sectarian allocation of homes, and by and large, Catholics couldn't get homes. And the civil rights movement kind of came out of that context. And one of the outcomes of it was a housing executive, a public body to allocate housing on the basis of need. So we're basically maintaining that we need a housing executive, and there's pressure to try and privatise parts of it in Stormont for complicated reasons about borrowing money and underfunding. But essentially, the result would be to privatise the landlord function of the housing executive. So we're making it clear that we need to resist any attempts to privatise any aspect of public services, but especially housing. Yeah. But also, we need to address the fact that the housing executive isn't building any homes, and that's a ministerial decision made 22 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really made 22 years ago. So we're challenging that, and we have been for some time. But also we've got a situation where we've got 20,000 empty homes in the north. So the homeless figures are around 84,000 in the north, and you've got 20,000 homes that are lying empty. So we're making the point that the government and the state needs to be proactive in acquiring these homes, or at the very least pressuring the landlords to use them. And on top of that, we're also in the early stages of drafting a people's housing bill through Stormont as a private member's bill. And basically what this would do, Samantha, is would reduce the cost of rents across the north, not allow landlords to increase rents more than once above the CPI rate of inflation every year, to tackle those empty homes and a few other measures. So we're making the point that Stormont has powers to tackle the housing crisis, but they've refused to implement them for forever, really, for many years.
Okay. And have you had much pushback from that? Because I did notice you had you had another article on your website about the Irish news columnist Brian Feeney. I couldn't get into reading it, but I did wonder how much pushback have you had about your housing ideas and your state construction?
Yeah, the pushback hasn't started yet, because we're just agitating, but it's going to come, you know, 100%, and we're kind of prepared for all cries of everything from landlords. And it always kind of, the argument always put towards us is that if you implement rent controls, then landlords will sell properties. And our point is, we can't be beholden to the wills and the profit desires of landlords. And actually, there's not a lot of evidence to say that when there's rent control or similar measures introduced, as a lot of European countries have, that landlords actually do sell, because most of them are still making a tidy sum. So
the pushback hasn't started. All countries have all these data, and people will ignore the truth of that data just to make a point, really, to make profits, I guess, more so.
I know, absolutely, 100%. So that's going to come. That pushback is going to be loud and quite vocal. But we're just in the early stages of the bill, so we haven't really received those responses yet.
Not yet, but you're getting prepared. Good on you. All right, well, then let's talk a little bit about the media, because obviously I don't know how, well, it sounds like you know a broad amount of history, but we look back at Rwanda, the Rwanda genocide, and precipitating that, there was a lot of words spoken on the radio, and I'm not actually sure about print, but definitely the radio. And our equivalent now is we've got obviously TV news, and we've got all these podcasts and radio that is a podcast on TV and so on. And so I wanted to ask you really about the sort of feelings or the what you were hearing leading up to what have been called, you know, the summer of discontent and far right race riots and so on. And, you know, there's a couple of names that have come up in my looking at this, because obviously I'm not in Ireland. I used to live in Dublin, but I'm not there now. But, you know, there's names like Colin Wallace and also Stephen Nolan, who's on the BBC. Did you listen to any of what they were saying? Because I know Stephen Nolan, eventually he did sort of, you know, he had a caller that came in talking, you've been very racist, and Stephen Nolan called him very racist, which is, I'm told, is quite odd for that man.
Another night of violent disorder, another night where the brave police officers are getting now petrol bombed. Last night, a citizen is being treated as a hate crime, having his head stamped on in the Donegal Road, Sandy Row area. What are we going to do about it? How much resource do the police need? How much do they have? And then this extraordinary interview with a racist. And yeah, we're not going to... There hasn't been much, actually. Vast majority of people are commenting, saying that this is what we need to see. But the racist element that is not indicative of the widespread community, but it's there, and that mindset of that deeply embedded, disgusting racism that is part of the mindset that empowers people to say that they don't want ethnic minority communities anywhere near them. That disgusting sentiment. We challenge a racist in Sandy Row, a blatant racist, all coming up on today's programme.
So what have you been hearing from on the radio and TV news and talk shows?
Yeah, I was actually on the radio after they played the clip of the gentleman and like Sandy Rowe, wasn't it, being racist. And I took a different position. I was kind of a bit aggrieved that the platform, somebody, you know, with those kind of nasty, despicable views. But anyway, that was just my own take on it with him. But well, I suppose really we'd say like the media and government policy is to blame in terms of like the rise in racism. You know, obviously you have your Tommy Robinsons and others who are trying to, you know, feed off that agenda and bring society in a really dark and, you know, destructive place. But we would make a point, Samantha, that it's government policy to dehumanize migrants generally, but asylum seekers in particular. You know, the hostile environment policy, which has basically treated all asylum seekers like criminals. They have a legal and a moral right to seek asylum. It's not illegal. There's no such thing as an illegal asylum seeker. But you wouldn't think that if you listen to you know, the Tories or even Starmer and many Starmer's team as well in recent months. And that has trickled down, and that has, you know, provided sort of admirable context for far-right fascist agitators to organise and to mobilise. And more locally, it's kind of, there's been a focus on obviously, there's been obviously quite a bit of racism in the last a year or so. There's been, you know, Nazi flags put up outside a mosque in West Belfast. There's been a number of sort of Muslim, Middle Eastern owned shops inside Belfast. burnt out last year, and some of those same ones were obviously burnt out more recently. And there's a bit of that. And by and large, the media has kind of condemned it. But there's also been a push in from some political quarters about legitimate concerns. You know, there's legitimate concerns. And they, yeah, I know. So I don't know how much that's been in Britain, but basically, and not everybody's in this category, but for a lot of people, that's basically some people are feeling the sort of the myths, the lies, and not real willing to challenge racism. And I'm talking about more political reps here who, when Stormont was recalled a few days after the sort of the violence and the racism, and the DUP politicians, the unionist politicians, a lot of them got up and talked about legitimate concern. Now, this isn't concerns about, like, you know, sort of numbers of as in, like, should the state, you know, how should the state sort of support migrants or provide services for migrants or services for the community generally. This is people who were basically don't really believe, you know, Muslims or people of colour should be in their city. So that's like it's fascist ideology and viewpoints.
So that is their backbone of their whole ideology. Actually, they just don't want people there. It's not about numbers and so on. It's just pure racism. Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, absolutely. And that, I would say so for the people at the centre of these organising the protests, certainly. Yeah. And some people who maybe feed into the narrative may have incorrect ideas about racism, and you could pull some of those in an anti-racist direction. But the people at the heart of them, Samantha, are definitely just hardcore racist, fascist, hardcore loyalist paramilitaries. And the point really is that we don't want you in our, as they would say, in our area, in our community. And that's been pretty clear. So I just think there's been a pandering to elements of that viewpoint in the media, and a lot of pandering by unionists in particular, which obviously gives people a sense that their views are legitimate and are getting a hearing when they shouldn't be.
How long have you felt you've heard this sort of thing coming from, for example, the DUP? Because it can't have just been the last year. Because obviously, you know, there was last summer in Dublin where there was a lot of, you know, trouble. I think the Daily Mail actually then called it the summer of discontent. So what can you identify?
Yeah, for quite a while, unfortunately. And Peter Robinson, the former First Minister, infamously said that he would only trust Muslims to go to the shop for him, which was a... obviously offensive, but a really bizarre comment to make. I think that was maybe 2012, 2013. And there was a big sort of demonstration of people, you know, led by the Muslim community to say that this is just really offensive and patronizing and racist. And then obviously there's been all sorts of examples in between where the DUP have just basically... given cover, or in many cases articulated, you know, racist and outright offensive views towards migrant communities. There's also been a bit of a campaign in the last maybe year or 2 years where loyalist paramilitaries are basically putting up posters in working class communities to basically to call what they would say foreigners vermin. The posters have said vermin on them. And the DUP really haven't really come out and condemned it strongly enough. You've kind of said again, oh, there's legitimate concerns.
So have you guys brought it up in Parliament? Sorry.
Yeah, we have, absolutely. And they've given a wink and a nod to this kind of stuff, whereas like they might sort of officially say it's not reflective of the community, which in many ways it's not, but it's obviously people, individuals and groups organising.
Yeah. And they've got families as well who they talk to who might not be on the streets but may agree.
Yeah, exactly. But they're obviously giving a wink and a nod to this at the very least. And their policies, generally speaking, have been one to not really welcome minorities to the north of Ireland. So, yeah, and when it comes to sort of policy, you know, we've got... a detention centre in Lorne House, which basically is the north of Ireland, the Justice Department, the police, and effectively ministers and the executive as well are implementing a prison system for people seeking asylum here. And the DUP know this, Sinn Féin know this, but they never talk about it in public. And ourselves and campaigners around End Deportations Belfast and many others, Samantha, call for this site to be shut down, but they don't do anything about it. And obviously that feeds into a culture of mistrust, dehumanizing, and fear directed towards, you know, people who are seeking safety, seeking asylum, as the title says. So I think they're all culpable from those perspectives in leading to an environment that isn't welcoming at all towards our.
Can I take you back to last year, 2023? I know you're in Belfast, but there was some really serious trouble in Dublin. I think a woman was stabbed and knifed. And nearly, very much nearly immediately, there was an uprising against it, because you touched on this website, but there's also the Telegram channels, obviously, mm-hmm. which people use. And so I believe she was stabbed by someone who, I mean, it turns out he's actually an Irish citizen. He is a person of colour, but Irish, not. But what happened was lots of people said that he was an asylum seeker and this and that and whatever. I mean, his name hasn't been reported. You've got better reporting structures there, it sounds like, with your judiciary system. Because here, obviously, we've had a very similar incident in Southport where the name of the person has been released. Again, because of similar things that happened, Telegram channels saying that it was this person who was an asylum seeker, and that they attacked these three little like innocent girls, and it's a horrible, horrific attack that happened, and murders, and it seems very similar to what happened in Dublin only a year ago. But I've been told that actually those Telegram channels were literally within 5 minutes of her being attacked, that it was on Telegram, and very soon after that, people were on the street sort of causing havoc. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, that, I think it was last October or November time in Dublin. I think is that the event you're talking about, Samantha?
There's two different things. There's one where I think children were attacked in a school, but there's another one where a woman was, and that's the one I'm talking about.
I think time's running out still, or did you?
No, I've got loads of time now.
Oh, right. No problem. So, and that seems to be the playbook, Samantha. I mean, you probably have maybe more insight in terms of how this may work in terms of on Telegram or whatever, but it seems to be that they're the playbook of the far right. You know, they, if there's a tragedy, and, you know, Southport, obviously, everybody thinks it was a tragedy. Similarly in Dublin, when a group of children were stabbed. But they seem to pick a moment and a tragedy when people are obviously asking what went on, and, you know, obviously not everything is out in the public domain. And I'm not saying it needs to be in a time when somebody is mourning or trying to understand really what happened to their loved one. But in those kind of contexts is when the far right intervene, and Dublin and Southport are the example. And the obvious point is, obviously, you know, unfortunately, we've got a problem, a real, real problem in Ireland of Irish-born white men, predominantly, killing, harming their partners or ex-partners. And of course, when this happens, these sort of far right agitators are nowhere, of course, to be seen. Even though they always talk about protecting children and protecting women.
Rishi called this election because he knew the planes were not going to Rwanda. He knew it. But he told us, it's okay, we've detained people. They've all been rounded up. They're in detention, waiting to go. Well, do you know that every single one of those has now been released on bail, and most have absconded? No planes were going to Rwanda. So we are clear. this country must leave the European Court of Human Rights and get back its sovereignty.
So obviously they've got a strategy to try and intervene in those difficult, awful circumstances to try and stoke up racism.
Couldn't book a room when we tried. We did try. They're booked for months and months, it would seem. I wonder why. Sure. Windows are open, so people are staying here. It just drove on, yeah. This is the Hilton Bromsgrove. Let's have a quick look.
Yes.
Just come and have a look. Can we book rooms here?
I'm afraid not.
When?
You can't book my boyfriend, sorry.
Right.
Look at the ground.
Can we look around?
Not really.
And really what you had was in last October, November, I think it was, sorry, last year.
Yeah.
You had a racist sort of mob out in the streets and chatting sort of real racist, nasty stuff. And in many ways, like, I don't think ultimately solely a policing approach is a solution to all this stuff. You know, obviously people are being attacked and being harassed and being threatened that they have a right to ring the police. There's questions about, massive questions about their conduct. But the only in the example of Dublin, the only moment that the police intervened was when property was attacked, when people started attacking shops, taking stuff from shops and looting shops. So there's massive questions about the Irish state, the guards and the police, the PSNI in the north, how they're basically willing to allow racism to exist, allowing it to fuel, fueling it rather. And really when it comes to sort of people on the left or migrants or people of color, their policing approach and tactics are completely different and really unnecessarily over the top and aggressive. So I think really you've seen a big mobilization in the south in different guises of the far right, and there's been sort of counter protests at times. And I think our point in Belfast is that we've a different sort of kettle of fish, if you will. We've got far right ideas, fascist ideas, and people who are fascist.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also got loyalist paramilitaries, you know, people who are armed.
Yeah, guns. I did want to talk to you about that, but just before, just to make sure that we've covered that what happened last November or October, we're not sort of completely certain. Yeah. You see similarities between what happened there and what happened in Southport. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do. I mean, obviously, I'm aware of the tragedy in Southport, and I'm aware of, you know, all the kind of the full aftermath, but it seems to be that, you know, people jump on a tragedy and obviously trying to mobilize against that.
Yeah.
They did, rather. It didn't seem to be they did. Sorry, they did do that. Yeah.
But do you think, do you see anything strange in the fact that it happened within 5 minutes of when she was attacked? Because I find that very strange that it was on Telegram by then. I mean, I don't know if you can comment on that or not. What do you think?
It certainly does. I mean, it raises questions of, you know, is there somebody in the police and in the guards and the state services who are leaking information? So it's very, very worrying. And I think really, you know, we make the point that, you know, the guards have there's a different perception of the guards in the south. You know, people have a history of the police service in the north and the troubles and all the kind of the sectarian role that they play in terms of policing people and so on and so forth. But in the south, the guards have really got a terrible record in terms of, you know, how they treat you know, people who are sleeping in tents, asylum seekers are sleeping in tents, or treated, you know, really aggressively by the police and by the state. But when it comes to far-right agitators, there's a hands-off approach. So it raises massive questions about what's the connection between elements of the state and far-right. And knowing anything about fascism, there's always a connection, and in many cases an overlap between, you know, sharing information, sharing who they perceive to be enemies, and kind of working hand in hand. So I don't know how deep that goes in that specific example, but there's always a connection there, which again shows us how, you know, we can't rely on the police to resolve this problem. We need to you know, have self-mobilization and put demands on the state to tackle the problem.
Okay, I've just got three more questions left. I feel I have three in my head. Let's see if we can get through them so that you can get on with your day. So now you touched on paramilitaries. Now I've been given so many acronyms for paramilitaries. So I've got the UUP, Ulster Unionist, TUV, the UDA, the Ulster Defence Association. And because you mentioned that that these, so when there is an epidemic, I'll use that word, you didn't use it, but of actually white Irish men killing their partners or women for whatever, you know, domestic or intimate partner violence, maybe there's outside of that, that is happening as well. I mean, that happens in the UK and England, Wales and Scotland too. I mean, it's a worldwide issue. And there's not much pushback on that because, you know, by these people who want to defend women and children. However, I've been told that so there is something that happens with somebody called the UDA, I think, the Ulster Defence Association. So they used to do something called kneecapping. So they would so when somebody stepped out of line within a community, they would such as selling drugs or they weren't not affiliated to their paramilitary or their cartel, if you want to call it. That's mafia, if you want to call it that. So, you know, so any drugs or antisocial behaviour, they would deal with it by something called kneecapping. But when it came to women and children, nothing much happened. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
All right. Okay. I mean, we don't want to go too much into it. Maybe I'll look into it further. But honestly, so just to kind of finish off, it was these paramilitary groups who were in Belfast who were going to the hotels and so on like that. Now, I've been told there's an area of Belfast called the Islington of Belfast, and that is in south Belfast. Is that an area where you get a lot of you had sort of far right or anti-Muslim or anti
So Sandy Row, the village, and other parts of South Belfast. I mean, it's kind of a very sort of strange juxtaposition. You've got very loyalist areas in terms of like Union Jacks and Israel flags, and then you have like sort of Middle Eastern markets and quite a number of sort of migrant owned shops and asylum seekers living in the area in terms of hotel accommodation, which isn't obviously suitable. And it's in those areas, not exclusively, but in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, where those shops were attacked and burnt down. Obviously, the paramilitaries in areas like South Belfast are going towards these sort of Middle Eastern markets and shops and cafes, and they're demanding protection money, and which basically means we'll look after you, and you know, a kind of mafia sort of style, protect you if you pay us whatever it is per month. I'm not sure what the figure is, and part of it is a sort of cleaning out of people from what they would see as their community, who are either not white or migrant or, you know, Muslim. So both those things are kind of going hand in hand. And really the problem is, you know, these paramilitary organizations, people detest them in the communities that they purport to represent, although they rarely stand for election, if at all. But the state has played a role in financing these community organisations to remain operating in some way, normally under the guise of another body or another group, but only that they're funding people who are directly connected to the primarily loyalist paramilitaries. So yeah, so that's really bolsters the standing of those organisations. But they're carrying out, you know, pogroms, and they're trying to clear out people from communities and do nothing about housing. They don't come on any housing protests, any housing campaigns, but at the same time they feed off the general discontent about housing that exists. Yeah. Across working class.
And that is kind of concentrated in the Islington of Belfast, or is that all around Belfast and Dublin, or where would you say that's happening?
What, the racism, sorry, or
this kind of protection racket and this animus against the people who are running.
Yeah, I mean it's quite concentrated in sort of that part of South Belfast, but it exists in other parts of the north as well, where paramilitaries have a grip on people. Yeah, unfortunately.
And is there less paramilitaries in Dublin, or no parliamentaries? Because one thing that I've come across is that a lot of people from Dublin actually went up to Belfast when the far right race riots were happening. Now, you saw people on these marches with the community says no, what was it, Colcock or whatever, says no. Those posters up in Belfast, and you also saw various flags, all sorts of flags, which had never been seen in the same place unless there was a fight going on, because somehow these people from the south and people from the north have joined forces, you know, against migrants and Muslims and asylum seekers. Isn't, you know, that's 400 years of trouble at least that's been swept over to target these people.
Somewhat, but I think it's kind of, there's been more made of that than what it is, in a sense, because, I mean, you saw people from Coolock, Coolock Says No, obviously,
came up
to Belfast. There seemed to be a handful of individuals there. There was much made of, Union Jack and a tricolour, say by say, but yeah, I think one of the people holding the tricolour actually had, you know, Union Jack sunglasses on, and many people are saying that this person probably was a loyalist. I don't know who the person was, but so I can't say for certain, but there's a perception around that. But really what kind of frustrates myself and others on the left and in the movements in Belfast is the media in the north went apoplectic about that small demonstration, and they threw fireworks, they done Nazi salutes and all sorts of nasty chanted sick the boats as well, real nasty individuals. Mm-hmm. But on the opposite side, there was several thousand people, you know, who were Muslim, atheist, Catholic, Protestant, maybe other, I'm sure, religions as well. But that's the diversity of that is never really focused on. Mm. So that's something called causes frustration. But it was nasty, but it was a gathering of
Resistance to it. So you said the media didn't talk much about the resistance, the opposition to this racism and far right sort of ideology and white replacement theory stuff. So who is the journalist Max Colbert? I think he's connected somehow to Heritage Foundation or something, and he's part of the Culture Wars. Is he some of the you know, have you come across him or people like him as sort of stoking this sort of thing?
I'm not sure who he is directly, to be honest, yet, but I mean there's others online here kind of normally anonymous, but there's others who you know, are kind of stirring a pot as well, you know.
Jamie Bryson?
Usually. Yeah, people like that, yeah. Absolutely.
Tell me about him. If you don't mind.
Well,
don't
have to. I mean, I've kind of somewhat loathe to talk about him, but obviously, you know, he represents.
Yeah, in the wider sense, what is going on there?
Yeah, the wider sense. Yeah, well, you got people like him who are basically taking to Twitter and kind of attacking not just myself, although he's doing that, they're tagging others who are taking a stand against racism, directly in a context where, and trying to say that the left is an anti-racist movement is somewhat fascist itself because it, you know, it doesn't let people speak, which is just absolutely absurd. But and some other people kind of paraphrase or take that kind of line of thinking. But you're talking about a sense of not like, you know, abstract debate about immigration and whether immigration controls are racist or not. It's not that. This is about people who are literally Sikh Island and supporting and carrying out the burning of shops and homes of people who are from Syria, Palestine, and Newton Abbey. I think there was an Indian restaurant, I think just 2 nights ago, was burnt out as well. So
Sikh Island, you know,
Sikh Island, absolutely. So really, this isn't people who are misunderstood. This is people who are far right agitators, you know, connected to either fascist groups or loyalist paramilitaries, and people like that are trying to give somewhat legitimacy, even though publicly they will say, "Oh, the burning of shops and properties of anybody is wrong and can't be justified." In terms of the core belief that there's too many migrants or asylum seekers are bad or there's a problem with Islam, which is at the core of obviously these fascist mobilizations, these kind of people on Twitter support that and give oxygen to that in occasionally nuanced ways, but fundamentally at the heart of it, that's what they do.
And you know, so talking about sort of fascist and Nazi ideology, do you think this is at least any way connected to the fact that Ireland was sort of neutral in the Second World War? I mean, I know that's a slightly a long shot, but I'd like to hear your answer.
Not really, to be perfectly honest, no. To be honest, no.
Yeah. But there is, within the far right, there is some sympathy to sort of the brown shirts and the you know, Spanish fascist ideology from then. Is that correct within the far right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you have a history of, you know, revolutionary struggle in Ireland, North and South, in terms of, you know, before and after partition. But you have the examples of what's called the blue shirts, which basically was the people emulating the brown and black shirts in Italy and Germany, but basically the early days of Fine Gael, which are now in government. So you've got that sort of far-right fascist views, you know, lurking, and somewhat, I'm not saying at the heart of the southern state, but, you know, those ideas and people in them kind of having sympathies with people in government. And you've anti-Semitism in Ireland and historically as well, but obviously you've people organizing against that in the south, like James Connolly, famously when he lived in Dublin, you know, agitated in support of a, you know, a small Jewish community, but agitated in support of them and against attacks. I think it was just shortly after the Dreyfus affair in France. So yeah, you do have but this kind of, this modern day fascism obviously plays on historical stuff in the sense that in the south they talk about we stood up to the British and we stood up to colonization, but now we're being recolonized. So they kind of use Ireland's anti-imperialist culture and language, but obviously in a completely wrong and
twisted way,
and a pro-imperialist way. Yeah, that they kind of attack migrants.
Yeah.
And in the north, it's a bit different. It's kind of a lot of those people who kind of are on the side of sort of loyalism would kind of always talk about how we in Britain, you know, fought fascism. But it's a different sort of backdrop, if you will, that allows these people to kind of grow. So I wouldn't say it's just because the 30s and the 20s, you had the pretty sure it's the same. It's kind of developed and
mutated, maybe is a good word for it. So all right, well, just to finish off, so there's those links, historical links, but now currently you mentioned him very briefly earlier, Tommy Robinson, and obviously we in the UK, at least England, actually, that's what I mean. We've had the National Front, we've had Britain First, we've had the BNP, the EDL. Now there doesn't seem to be a name for what's happening, but there's a lot of people involved. And I know that Tommy Robinson, also known as, well, originally known as Stephen Yaxley Lennon, who is half Irish. Mm-hmm. Now, he has an Irish mm-hmm. passport, and he lives wherever he does in the world. Apparently, the British police can't find him. They arrested him on a Schedule 7, let him go. And just a couple of days later, we had far race riots. I don't know where he is, but he's, I'm sure, potentially enjoying what's happened since he left England. But I wondered if you knew much about the links between him, all those different BNP, Britain First and so on, and National Front going back years, and their connections to the far right in Northern Ireland, in the north of Ireland, but also specifically to these, you know, the paramilitary groups, which I will actually from now on call cartels, because I see them as a mafia, it seems, more than paramilitary, because if they're running, as I've been told, and I don't need you to comment on this, but I've been told that they also, you know, are involved in prostitution, in drugs, in all sorts of things. So it seems more like they're, you know, a kind of ISIS, because ISIS, people think that was about religion, but to me, ISIS is like a mafia who were looking at resources, and that was their thing. You know, that's why they were taking these old artifacts and selling them and trying to get oil and divert gas and all of that. It was a cartel. And what I hear from people I'm talking to, and potentially a little bit of what you've said, is that these people, like the UVF, UDA, all of the acronyms, are quite like a cartel. And in England, like the Tommy Robinsons, all of those, the EDL, the NF, they've never been called cartels. That was always, it was just, they are racist and they do racist murders. That is what they were seen as. But I do wonder about if they are also running all these different things, because drugs, prostitution, if how close they are, how similar they are to what is the groups in the north of Ireland. And obviously you mentioned in Dublin that none of this, you know, with this Telegram thing, somebody is informing, and that's likely somebody in the police. But it also could potentially be, you know, MI5, MI6, special branch and so on, because they work all the way, you know, a lot of places. I mean, I've just said a lot, but if you could comment and maybe unpick some of that about the links between England and the north of Ireland, please.
I mean, you could be well right about the latter stuff, and we have no idea who's directing a lot of this, you know, in terms of state forces and that. So you may well be right about that. In terms of the north, I mean, we've had examples where we had a formerly the traditional unionist voice, reform type party, and as in reform the party, in Belfast, one of their former councillors tried to organise in 2019 around Tommy Robinson, and if memory serves me correct, I think he maybe had a court or a trial at that time as well. And so basically this was an attempt to try and merge, you know, Sandy Rowe, loyalist kind of agitators alongside Tommy Robinson. And they had a demonstration in Belfast, a couple of demonstrations in Belfast. One of them was several hundred and some were smaller. So like even going back a couple of years, there's an attempt to try and, you know, merge like Ulster loyalism with sort of far right and on many cases outright fascist ideas, and there's a bit of an overlap in terms of some of the ideas, but in many ways kind of loyalism has operated suppose independently, in the sense that they're not directed by Tommy Robinson, you know, they're not directed by the National Front, but you know, at times when they've seen it beneficial to form alliances, they operate sort of independently, but they can come together when it comes to, you know, whipping up Islamophobia and so on and so forth. But very much the paramilitaries are kind of their own beast in many ways. But they've been allowed to exist and they've been funded historically directly, but you know now indirectly by the state. And it's people in those organizations, those connected to them, who are kind of leading the charge about migrants and asylum seekers housing. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. But there has been attempts where people have tried to work with Tommy Robinson. The Britain First team were over Paul Golding and Jada Franson were over in that time period. I think it was 2019 or 2018. So they were trying to work with Northern paramilitaries. And there was a form of, there was several protests and demonstrations, but in terms of how that materialized or lasted in terms of lasting organizations, I don't think there's anything in terms of a joint organization as such, but they did work together and they have done in the last few years.
Okay, so in that case then I will ask excuse me one second, just to kind of finish off now. So I believe so you mentioned all those different things, migrant and also, but there's also this trans issue as well, and something that's happened just even this week, I believe, that there's some laws that are going to be brought in that are, you know, nominally or in actuality sort of anti-trans, which I don't believe you have a big population of, as we don't in England either. And at the same time, you told me that in 2019 you had Britain First come up and blah 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 and all those and things then happened. And at the same time, we've had Keir Starmer come to Ireland this week, and suddenly now there's anti-trans legislation that's going to go ahead, which didn't look like it was going to go ahead before that. What do you think? There's some links there with what's coming from England to Ireland.
I mean, if it's, I don't know if it's Keir Starmer directly involved, but you know. It's worth asking that question, but I think I suspect it's more the sort of anti-trans panic in England and in America, which primarily is where it's located, obviously, in Scotland, I suppose, as well. That this kind of the North kind of feeding into that. But also, I mean, it's worth mentioning, I mean, the party they're trying to ban puberty blockers, or certainly begin the process of limiting puberty blockers. Mm-hmm. And as you said, a small tiny community that's completely marginalized, completely dragged through the media and, you know, analyzed and mocked and all sorts of things. And obviously that's what the minister's attempting to do. Mm. But the minister's party, the Ulster Unionist Party, are going through an absolute crisis. They've got rid of their party leader. They're being torn apart publicly, somewhat by themselves, somewhat by others, and it's a bit of a shit show. I can't cope that, but I can't think of another word.
That's fine. We can say that.
Okay, but so in that context, and in the context of a rising far right and a rising anti-trans sort of movement, you know, great distraction, great kind of trying to evade people once again. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. And there's been a bit of form before, bit of a tangent. The current MP for East Antrim, the former health minister, tried to do something similar. I think it was after the cast review. He kind of indicated that he was going to restrict trans sort of services somewhat. So that's been lurking for a while. But I think they find a good opportunity in the middle of the summer, when the UUP are in crisis, and when, as you said, there's a rise in anti-trans sentiment, to try and put this argument out there. And who knows what Keir Starmer said. I mean, his record is pretty appalling on many things, but especially sort of trans rights. So I don't know if there was a quiet word in an ear, but you know, I'm sure that
possibly, possibly. But I mean, also to think about those links between the UK and sorry, not the UK, England and Ireland. You've got so here we have something called Spiked Online, which originates through the Revolutionary Communist Party, which was had various members, but specifically something that I've written about is Baroness Claire Fox of Buckley, I think she's called, and she was a revolutionary communist. So she's got a big history with the north of Ireland, with because of some of the comments she's made about old the comments that the party made about the IRA. Now, obviously, there was some agitation around trying to get her peerage stopped. It didn't work. The reason it didn't work, it turns out, which I have on record and the BBC have written about, is that she had some, this was while Boris Johnson was in power, she had some friends, obviously, who, one specifically, Munira Mirza, who was in the Revolutionary Communist Party with her. And so Munira Mirza, when Boris Johnson was in power, was actually the number 10 policy advisor. And her husband, Dougie, I forget his surname, possibly Smith, is someone who has advised probably the last three, at least, Conservative prime ministers. Now, they were the ones that were able to push through Claire Fox's peerage, it turns out, according to the Times. And but the thing is, you know, even though, you know, they had a lot of pushback from people in Ireland, you know, people whose children had died, had been killed. But then, and she tried to, you know, sort of clean up her image, Baroness Fox. But the point is why I mention her is because she is someone who ran the Institute of Ideas, but also was very integral in the founding of Spiked Online, which does perpetuate all of these sort of things we've said, anti-migrant, anti-asylum seeker, anti-trans, that sort of thing. But they have a very similar kind of... it's not a sister paper, but it is very similar, I've heard, called Gripped in Ireland. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I have, yeah. I can't remember the gentleman, the person who runs it, but it's known as a far-right kind of Twitter page and website, yeah. So it's, yeah. Less popular in the north, thankfully, but people kind of would, in the south, would tend to know about it and challenge it, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, all these sort of links that go from England to Ireland, whether it's in the north or in the south and Dublin, but there's so many similarities, which always demand questions, obviously. So just to finish off, I wanted to ask you, like, because we have talked about various parliamentary groups and I've mentioned the names, the acronyms and so on. And I know that having talked to other people before speaking to you, most of them do not want to go public. Now, you have said that you are happy to be quoted in any article. Obviously, I'm going to run the quotes by you. But, you know, so the point I'm making is, how do you keep safe? I mean, you've said this all on the record now, so...
Safe in numbers, you know. I mean, obviously we've got you know, a problem with paramilitaries, but I mean, we've got communities that don't feel safe, you know, and that's not me, that's people who are, you know, asylum seeker or a migrant or people who are Muslim. So I think the only way we can keep safe is in numbers and look out for and look after each other. And I think that's which there's still, unfortunately, racist attacks happening. I think a lot of the kind of the attacks on shops in particular in Belfast, they've stopped for now, and I have to say it's for now, because there's been like, we had 15,000 people in a protest, in an anti-racist demonstration in Belfast, which, you know, was... Compared to the London is a smaller city, but I think London was impressive too. But I think it was much higher in that sense. So
wasn't there a journalist attacked at one of these though?
Yeah, Kevin Scott was attacked in, I think it was the Shankill or one of the protests. Yeah, Yeah, I think it was Kevin Scott, a journalist, and his car was attacked as well. So I think we'll have to be understand that the threat is real, and understand that, you know, who is sort at risk, if you will. But to look out for each other, to build, you know, organization and demonstration on the streets that can isolate the sort of far right and loyalist paramilitaries. And I think that's the only hope we've got, you know, because we can't rely on the state, we can't rely on the government, who have pandered to, you know, racism and paramilitarism for decades. Yeah. So our only strength, if you will, is with each other and standing together. Yeah. And that's what we're trying to do. And hopefully that can give a bit of hope to people. I mean, the Belfast Mila Festival, which is kind of multicultural dance and music arts festival, that happens. Last week was their rally, their carnival. And they were a bit concerned about, you know, possible attacks and possible, you know, implications of the racist violence. And Nisha Tandon, their chief executive or their organizer, said that, you know, let's give sort of communities that they work with and represent confidence. It's a large scale mobilization, so we can't be complacent, because obviously racism is unfortunately deep and endemic. But we're focusing on working collectively and working with unions, mm-hmm. other racist organizations, and hopefully that'll mm-hmm. keep people safe, as you asked, but also push back against the.
What has union mobilization looked like, actually, against this far right threat?
They've been good, yeah. Some have been good. Some unions have been kind of slower to come out, to be perfectly honest. But organizations like NIPSA have kind of played an important role in helping. There was a United Against Racism, the 15,000 people protest. It was organized by United Against Racism and supported by 161 different organizations.
Oh, wow.
But NIPSA played an important role in helping some funding and other aspects of organizing that protest. So unions have been coming out. Individual trade unions have been strong, but officially some trade unions have been slow to act. But there was a protest in Stormont organized by the Irish Congress of Trade Unions on the day of the Stormont recall. So I think it was like the 8th or 9th of August, whatever date that was. So yeah, the unions have been. Yeah, no, this year, sorry. Unions have an important role to play in our view, but obviously we need to sometimes put them in the action.
Well, just to finish off then, can you tell us how to get in contact with you, with People Before Profit, how to get involved in all these groups that are sort of mobilising against far-right threat, against, that is marginalising and keeping people of colour, migrants, asylum seekers in hiding? How do they get involved with what you're doing?
Yeah, just get involved, check out our social medias, check out groups like United Against Racism, and check out what sort of anti-partitions Belfast and the trade unions are doing as well. And I just encourage people to get involved with activism, and get involved with People for Profit if you like what we're about. But, you know, importantly, get involved in anti-fascist and anti-racist struggle, because we need people not to be on the sidelines, but to be activists in our communities and our workplaces. And you know, fight on many fronts, but, you know, in this current period, to be strong and fight against racism and fascism.
Okay, thank you so much, Jerry. I appreciate you taking the time. It's longer than we thought it would be, and we had a few stops and starts, but honestly, it's brilliant.